from the Rhodes Center for International Economics and Finance at the Watson School at Brown University. My name's Mark Blythe. I'm the host of the Rhodes Center podcast. At the end of last semester, I had a chance to talk to Lee Downey. She's a political theorist in London at King's, and she has a book out called Our Money, Monetary Policy as If Democracy Matters. And we had a good, wide-ranging talk about monetary policy, central banks, and the whole shebang. We plan to release that conversation this fall, but in the interim, a few things have happened which have, let's say, altered the conversation around central banking in the United States and elsewhere. So we decided to call Lee back up for a follow-up and kind of incorporate those new things into our old conversation. So what we've got here is a two-parter. Part one, which you're going to hear this week, is the original conversation. Part two is the update where we basically plug in all the stuff that we've learned since then. One other thing to note, if you'd rather watch this conversation, you can find the video version by searching the Rhodes Center podcast on YouTube. All right, here's the first of those two conversations. Leah, welcome to the pod.
Thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
So the first thing I should do is apologize for mispronouncing your name for the first 5 years that I knew you. So put listeners in the context of this. Leah, L-E-A-H, if you're Scottish, would be Lee. Mm-hmm. So for the first 5 years I knew Leah, I said Lee. Mm-hmm. And then eventually she said, you know, my name's Leah. And I went, oh,
yeah,
that was rather awkward. So putting that to one side, we're here today to talk about this fabulous new book, which is Our Money, Monetary Policy as If Democracy Matters. I mean, the title kind of like says quite a lot, doesn't it? Yes. I mean, the as if bit. Yeah. Did you have to fight to get it in italics?
Yeah, actually. Yeah. I fought a little bit to get it in italics, and I fought to get on the back the little note about it being legal tender.
Ah, right, mm-hmm. right. Okay, mm-hmm. yeah. Which, of course, could be a counterfeit claim.
There you go.
There you go. Yeah. So you watch out for that. All right. So let's set the stage for this, right? Central banks. Mm-hmm. Loads of people have written about central banks. They became the sort of like quintessential domestic and international economic governors.
Yep.
We delegated pretty much every responsibility we could to them on the basis of a theory that politicians can't be trusted with money ever.
Yep.
Right? About time and consistency. Mm-hmm. And we thought, well, that's good. So then we'll give it to these unelected technocrats.
Right.
Then came the financial crisis. And they basically have two tools, which is raise and lower the price of borrowing money and buy and sell some assets to influence liquidity conditions, right?
Yeah.
And it turned out that wasn't enough to stem the aspects of the crisis, even if they stopped the economy falling through the floor. They are also a bit prone to austerity. Mm-hmm. And for a while, they were held in quite maladeur. Mm-hmm. Then along came COVID. Mm-hmm. And COVID, we asked them again to deal with inflation rather than deflation, which was the policy the last time. And they didn't do that bad a job with it. So yeah, two cheers for central banks, right? But along comes Leah, and mm-hmm. Leah says, hang on a minute, this is not right, because ultimately this isn't just about some kind of technical argument about political business cycles or something like this. There's deep philosophical questions here as to what we're doing and why we're doing it, and that's what you try and explore. So just open this up for us. What's the big picture story here?
Yeah, definitely. So you're right in that I sort of start from first principles in the book, right? So what do central banks do? Well, they do lots of things, but one of the main things that they do is engage in monetary policy. And for me, in the book, I define monetary policy as the regulation of money creation, right? So central banks, of course, create money themselves, but they also regulate private money creation that we see happening in private financial industries. So when you just think of it that way, it's like that's a massive state power, right? Like, when do we create money? On what basis do we create money? How do we create money? Who does it go to? And that has huge implications for how we sort of create and recreate our social world, our political world, our physical world, and that's just politics, right? Right. So the fact that those two things are thought to be separable is just kind of just bizarre from a sort of observational perspective. And then essentially what the book does is it does a deep dive into the reasons for and against separating those things, right? And essentially I say the reasons for separating them and central bank independence are not quite as compelling as we might have thought that they were. Okay. And the reasons against it are actually really quite important. So we kind of have things backwards a little bit.
Yeah. So you're a central bank revisionist.
Yeah, you could say that.
You could say that. Yeah. Okay. So let's take this one step at a time then, right?
Yeah.
What is the difference in your mind between fiscal and monetary policy, and why is that important?
Very good question. I guess the sort of mundane answer is that fiscal policy as currently constructed, right, is about sort of tax and spend, right? And usually happens in the legislature. Monetary policy is more macro in a sense. It's less about distribution explicitly, mm-hmm. although of course it has massive distributional consequences, and more about how do we steer the economy as a whole, right? How do we speed it up, slow it down, push it in different directions?
But you speed things up by giving people a tax cut.
Yeah. No, right? I think that they're like very, I think they're fundamentally inextricably linked. Like, right. I think that the division is pretty artificial.
So then why does the division exist and who benefits from the division?
Well, there we go. So the division exists, I think, at least at an institutional level, right? If you go back in the US, for instance, to the founding of the Fed, 1913, the point there was you were really, you're creating an institution in reaction to a crisis. So there'd been quite a few financial crises leading up to that period that the private financial world was having to deal with itself. And that just was becoming infeasible, or if they didn't want to do it, right? They wanted help from the government. The government wanted more stability in finance. There was also a desire from the financial world to have a central bank, because what they noticed was that central banks existed in Europe. And not only did that prevent things like bank runs, it also enabled the bank to make a lot more money, because they didn't have to worry about bank runs and things. The state would take care of it. So they get to mobilize finance in a more profitable way. So the bank was essentially created explicitly, right, to sustain the stability and effectiveness of the private financial industry.
Right.
And at the time, it was really much more of a public-private partnership than it is today. I mean, it was formally constructed as a banker's bank, right? So private banks then and now own the Federal Reserve System in a sort of meaningful sense. But as history progresses, it becomes more of an engine of public policy, right? So how are we're going to actually engage in buying and selling assets, in adjusting interest rates, in regulation from a public policy perspective. But the aim kind of never changes, right? So we now have the institution in the United States that is in charge of the regulation of money creation from the perspective of the government, right? Public policy, doing that in order to sustain the stability of the private financial system.
Right.
And like, if you think about that from first principles, it's a bit strange. Historically, it makes sense. And I go into that in the book in terms of like why that happened. But just from first principles, from a democratic perspective, it's a bit weird.
Okay, but spell that out, because people might not really think that one through. Why is that weird? What are these first principles?
That's weird because one might think that in a democratic society, if we think of democracy as a form of government in which citizens collectively steer policy, right? So they're actually determining the rules that they live by, that it would be strange that you'd have an institution within the government that is ostensibly democratic that is pretty much just securing policy in the interest of a particular sector that is at times explicitly diametrically opposed to the legislature that's meant to be instituting policy from a more traditionally democratic perspective.
So if I put my central bank hat on, I've got one under here.
Yeah.
So I put on my central bank and I go, well, you know, I can understand those democratic concerns, but ultimately, you know, we have transparency in our deliberations. Yep. And ultimately, all the stuff the legislature wants, you can't have unless you have monetary stability. So therefore, you need to let us do our job and then you can do your job, right? That's what's wrong with that argument.
Great. So two things are wrong with that argument, in my view. The first is I just agree. And in the book, the sort of gambit of the book, right, is that the Fed is actually both democratically legitimate and accountable and yet still a problem for democracy. So how does that work, right? So because most people critiquing contemporary central banks say it should be more accountable or it's actually not legitimate. And I disagree with that. Like, I think it is set up like most of the rest of the administrative state. It's delegated power from the legislature. The legislature decided that itself, and it's held accountable, like, right, for its past actions. The problem is that leaves no space for the central bank to guide policy going forward, right? So my favorite quote about this is actually from a British case where an MP says to the governor of the Bank of England, who's testifying in front of Parliament, like, I'm paraphrasing, but essentially, like, what good is this sort of accountability where I just ask you a question and you give me a very erudite explanation? Like, what sort of power does that give me as mm-hmm. a democratic official? So that's the gap that I think we have, right? Then to the second part of your question, which is, yeah, okay, but maybe we give up on that because price stability is really important. Well, I just don't buy the argument that you can't have some degree of price stability, right? And quote unquote good monetary policy in a world in which the central bank is like most other administrative agencies, right? Mm-hmm. Like, why is it special? The argument for it being special, I don't buy. And I think it just gives it more, a degree of dominance, actually, right. and separation that ultimately, that causes the big problem for democracy, which is that it's not that the legislature needs to be making monetary mm-hmm. policy every day, but it needs to maintain the sense that it has power over that
right.
and could do things differently. So that starts to erode when you've got the central bank doing its own mm-hmm. thing for an extended period of time, kind of in whatever way and towards whatever ends it wants.
Mm, okay. So taking your revisionism seriously here, this leads us to a place where, you know, my other central bank hat.
You have two.
I have two. Wow. An even stricter central bank hat says, yeah, but you've got a rather naive view of politics, haven't mm-hmm. you? Because ultimately, we know there are a bunch of money-grubbing careerists who will, like, throw their grandma under a bus for an extra $5. They can't be trusted. They're time inconsistent, if you want to be fancy about it.
Yep.
And they can't make credible commitments. Yep. This is the Odysseus, right? Odysseus it's problem.
Either way.
Well, it's true. I always think, no, but the weird thing is, when you have Ulysses in your head, I immediately jump to James Joyce.
Yeah, okay.
And, like, the James Joyce central bank story suddenly gets really weird, right? So let's not do James Joyce.
Okay.
Let's
we'll do Odysseus.
Yes, it does. Ulysses and the Sirens, right? So isn't that the usual thing? They can't be trusted, etc.
Yes. So this is the classic story, right? So Ulysses, Odysseus, whoever, right, wanted to listen to the sirens on the boat. And so in order to avoid the temptation of the siren sound and crashing the boat, he essentially had his crew tie him to the mast of the boat and the crew sailed the ship and he got to hear the song. And so the analogy goes that the legislature, to avoid the temptation of bad policy, should tie itself to the mast of central bank independence. Mm-hmm. Now, like, we could spend an entire podcast just going through the problems with that analogy, in my view. There are many. Mm-hmm. It's not actually a useful analogy. But just to stick to the, like, original question of sort of, aren't politicians just sort of terrible and very simplistic people, and why would we ever give them power, mm-hmm. especially over money? Well, I just think that that model is way too simple, right? So think of it. Let's start here. There are obviously policies, tax policies, military policies, mm-hmm. environmental policies, immigration policies that would seem very attractive in the short term right before an election, right? That would have bad long-term consequences. And yet, we still seem to think, and not even demand, that those policies are under the power of elected officials.
Right?
Okay. So how is that different to monetary policy in that instance, right? So in the same, the second thing I would say is that I think it's pretty unfair to elected officials and voters to suggest that they're really that simple, mm-hmm. right? That they don't actually consider long-term consequences, right? So, you know, just all the things I just mentioned, right? Consider tax policy. Suppose somebody's running for office. They say, I'm going to eliminate taxes completely, yes. right? Everyone vote for me. Like,
it's actually going on just
yeah.
now. This is no longer a thought experiment.
No comment. Yeah, exactly. But so, like, imagine then what happens, right? First of all, some voters don't believe them, right? Other politicians say, hey, dude, that's going to have really bad long-term consequences. So, like, people aren't just mm-hmm. idiots, right? Mm-hmm. Not all of them, at least. And so the idea that that model is true, I just don't find very compelling. And more evidence for that is central bank independence, right? Mm-hmm. The legislature could eliminate the Fed and juice the markets tomorrow.
True.
Right? But it doesn't because mm-hmm. it has some degree of care for long-term consequences.
Right?
So I just think the model is a bit too, like,
too simplistic.
Simple. Yeah, right. Exactly. It's just not a good reflection of reality.
So does that solve the problem of trust? I mean, we are in a moment whereby, you know, we're now betting the house on a theory of tariffs, which is shared by precisely three people.
Can you call that what they share a theory?
I think you can. I actually take it more seriously than most, in the sense that if you think that, you know, with the demise of TTIP and TPP, you know, basically, and then, you know, the IRA behind Trump's tariffs, et cetera, right, as infant industry protection. I mean, the free trade consensus died in 2015.
Rightfully
and that was 10, right, and that was 10 years ago, right?
Yeah.
So, well, let's take this as an analogy for this then, right? I mean, are you part of a kind of like movement that 10 years from now you want to see the end of central bank independence?
Yes and no, right? Well, like yes.
Don't have it both ways. I mean, yes or no, right?
Well, then I guess in a simple sense, yes, mm-hmm. right? Like, okay, so let me give you the story on this, right?
Go on.
So I think this is important to say. One of the core observations in the book, which seems pretty obvious, but I think has pretty consequential consequences, if you will, is that any monetary policy that is constructed as if democracy matters will have to be political, mm-hmm. right? Just foundationally, democracy is a political form of governance. So if you want to exert democratic power over monetary policy has to be in the political domain. Mm-hmm. But of course, for something to be political, doesn't mean, A, that it has a particular politics, mm-hmm. right? So for it to be political doesn't mean that we need to be using monetary policy to achieve particular partisan ends. And second, just because democratic monetary policy is political doesn't mean all political monetary policy is democratic,
right?
So if we have the president running monetary policy on the basis of a whim, mm-hmm. that is not what I'm arguing for here. So that would be a form of no more central bank independence, mm-hmm. but it's not the form I would want to see.
Okay.
Right? And like there are very good reasons for that. Like even just the very obvious constitutional reasons that makes the president look a lot like a king. There's a reason the president doesn't have powers of the purse, and monetary policy is a form of power of the purse.
Right.
Right? So that's pretty clear. But I would want to see it, right? Like if the legislature were to institute what I suggest that they should in the book, that would be the end of central bank independence as we know it today.
Right.
For sure.
All right. So before we get to your final concrete suggestions, let's just work it through by stages again, right? Well, why not just go with more accountability, right? Because they used to be, you know, there was nothing. And then basically you started to get the speeches that they were all redacted, right?
Yeah.
And then they did less reduction. And then they started to go for forward guidance, which was basically, I'm telling you what I'm going to do, right?
Which is, of course, time inconsistent.
Right.
Can be. Yeah.
It's true, right? Yeah. Fair point, actually.
Yeah.
So, you know, why not just go with more transparency in the sense that, or more accountability or different accountability mechanisms? Because it seems to me that we still, even if politicians are more sophisticated, et cetera, right? We can have, let's say, how can I put this? The Yahoo quotient, right? The sort of like, and you didn't see that one coming, but there you go, right? Yep. And surely it's better to have some kind of, you know, independence in what is an absolutely crucial function for everyone, money creation, rather than sort of like, oh, now I will just run the printing presses, right?
Yeah. Okay, I want to say two things there. One about the Yahoos, whatever you want to call them, and the other about accountability. So the first is that it's important to like really reckon with the fact that democracy is risky, like properly construed. Like democracy is risky, particularly for those people who benefit from the status quo. Because you are opening yourself up. You have, for it to be democratic, you genuinely have to open yourself up to being ruled by people you disagree with.
Right.
So like that's like an uncomfortable feeling that we all have to get used to if we actually want a proper democracy. But secondly, I think the Yahoo issue is a little bit worse in the US currently. Because of this sort of delegation, right?
So that's the problem?
Partly, yeah.
Oh, right.
So
me through that one.
So when you delegate meaningful power away from the legislature, right? Like power like that can actually achieve stuff for people, you incentivize a certain performative style of politics, right? Let's build wall and make Mexico pay for it, right? Like let's have clean air and water for everyone. Like no child left behind, right? Mm-hmm. When you're not actually responsible for delivering that and you delegate that power to an administrative agency and say, get that done, then you create this kind of performativity in the legislature. And it's a vicious cycle, right? Because once the performativity happens, everyone's like, why would we give those crazy people any more power?
Yeah, because they're crazy.
Because they're crazy.
Right.
And so more power goes to the administrative state, more performativity, more power to the administrative. So I actually think there's a cycle here that is making the problem worse.
There's another version of that, though, is if the American one is the sort of like the performativity one. What you get with the British one, where you currently reside, is a sort of, in a sense, it's classically the British version of this. Right? The American one would be like loud and performative. And the British one is basically a world in which there's nothing to do because the Bank of England have got this and the fiscal rules have got the fiscal side, right? And so literally you show up in Parliament and you just wait for results.
Yep.
And that's why you end up doing sort of legislation about nonsense,
exactly.
because there's just nothing for you to do.
Yeah.
So that is hollowing out democracy.
Exactly.
So that's, so I think I'm buying more of this.
Okay,
right?
Okay.
Now, okay, if that's the case that basically politicians, even it's not that they can be trusted, you should put more power in their hands because that's the essence of democracy. And if you keep taking the power away and giving it to technocrats, then you're undermining democracy, which leads to all sorts of complications, probably worse than the thing you would solve with the delegation, right? This is where we are, right? What does your ideal form of independent central bank look like?
Yeah. So this is where we come to accountability, right, that you brought up before, mm-hmm. where a lot of people want more accountability and more transparency, which makes sense because they go together, right? So
right.
It's a classic theory of accountability, you use transparency to figure out what people did in the past. You then apply the rules that existed at the time and potentially punish them if they violated the rules, right? So this is what we see with legislatures all the time, because rather than the courts, usually it's the legislature that holds the central bank to account. You come in front of the legislature.
Right.
What did you do? Why did you do it? Okay, fine. It was within the mandate or not. What they don't have, and what my suggestion is a way for the legislature to regularly know and show its power over the central bank, right? So to engage in not this backward-looking accountability mm-hmm. mechanism, but a forward-looking way of steering policy,
okay.
right? So this is what I call iterative governance, mm-hmm. right? So it's essentially active management of the legislature, by the legislature of the central bank.
So does this mean giving them targets? Does this mean saying we want credit policy that looks like this?
So it could be lots of different things, right, in theory. The ones that I suggest in the book in the context of U.S. monetary policy are regularly rechartering the Federal Reserve. So that would, which historically, by the way, was already the case, and which would enable the legislature to sort of steer things going forward at an institutional level, right? So should reserve banks that are all over the country still actually be owned and pay dividends to private industry, right? Or should they be, you know, regional investment banks or,
right.
you know, this kind of thing? Should we be paying interest on reserves, or should we have, you know, all of these sorts of questions, like institutional questions? Then I also suggest a more like an annual form of credit guidance,
mm-hmm.
right? And so what this would be is the legislature voting on the way I cash it out in the book is voting on what I call a preferred asset taxonomy.
Mm-hmm.
So you could have a way of scoring assets that are like, we want more in this region, we want more in this sector, we want fewer here, blah, 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 blah. But it could be as extensive or limited as they wanted, right? So essentially they could vote every year and say,
mm-hmm.
we want no credit policy.
Right.
But that's what we're saying explicitly to you,
right.
right? Or they could say, we want to see more credit allocation in the west of the country and in green energy and, you know, less mm-hmm. in healthcare. I don't
right.
know, whatever. But they would be taking a stand in mm-hmm. an explicit way, which would bring home to both citizens and the central bank and the elected officials themselves that they actually do have levers of power over how this works. This
and they would
natural.
Be held responsible for the outcomes.
Exactly.
But, I mean, you know, you live in the UK, so maybe it looks different there because they're mm-hmm. all, you know, constrained with their fiscal rules and their targets and everything, right?
Yeah.
But here, I mean, I'm just thinking about the past 8 years, right?
Yeah.
So if you have annual credit guidance, let's just shorthand call it that, or
yeah.
at least, you know, a 3-year window or whatever
yeah,
it is,
yeah, yeah.
right? You do this sort of stuff. So we're going to set up the IRA.
Yep.
We're going to do all this stuff. And then the new guy comes in
mm-hmm.
and then basically dismantles the whole thing.
Yep.
You're going to get tremendous volatility in this.
Mm-hmm.
And if this was just a normal country, that would be fine. But it does print the global reserve asset.
Yep.
And all of these things would be hugely disruptive.
Mm-hmm.
And the people who are affected by it are truly global, right? Do you really want to bring that level of volatility into this thing?
Yeah. Well, I think it's important to distinguish between what we think about as volatility and what we think about as variation, right? So volatility is generally thought of as sort of unpredictable and undesirable,
right?
Right. So like you don't see it coming and all of a sudden, boom,
mm-hmm.
right?
Or just you could know it's coming in the sense that the other guy's going to win the election and
right.
what you're going to do is dismantle everything you did for the past three
right.
years. So
right.
anyone who did investment decisions based upon your guidance is now carrying the wrong end of the bag.
Right, right, right. But essentially what I argue is that you're always going to get some degree of political volatility or variation
mm-hmm.
in monetary policy because it like, you know, take the crisis, right? When things go down, then big time, then the government steps in,
right?
right? Or somebody is elected who decides, I'm going to get involved in this because I can. And they do. You know, so it's always kind of lurking in the background. Mm-hmm. The question is, does it happen sort of unpredictably and erratically and really dangerously? Or do you allow for a mechanism that enables political input into the system at a regular basis that is actually predictable? So the markets see coming, kind of like an election where, okay, you know, this guy's going to get elected. Maybe he's going to do some crazy stuff, but we see that kind of coming.
Yes.
So it's undoubtable that there would be more variation in the system because it would be more politically inflected, right? This is back to the observation that for it to be democratic, it's got to be political in a meaningful sense. Mm-hmm. That means there probably will be more volatility. But you try and do it in a way that is sort of predictable and desirable, right? And allows for people to kind of see it coming, to interpret it, and also to kind of guide it, right? So like if there's somebody who's coming about to run for office and they're saying they're going to do this and it's going to explode the entire global economy, mm-hmm. like, well, recent evidence says maybe we vote for them anyway. Right. But like maybe you don't. Maybe someone argues against it, that kind of stuff. So,
but with the Fed in particular, it's the global central bank. Nobody wants to talk about this, right?
Yeah.
So in a world of relatively closed economies that make the same stuff and occasionally swap things with each other, right? Sort of where the current incumbents would like to get back to, in a sense.
Yeah.
You can have highly accountable, in your sense, central banking.
Yeah.
But let me give an example, and I'll call this the Aditi question, and you will understand why,
I will, yeah.
So this is after Aditi Sahasrabudi, one of our friends and colleagues, who writes on swaps, right?
Yep.
So what the Fed does is it has these swap networks. Mm-hmm. And the swap networks make total sense from the point of view of a global governance problem. So basically, for those who don't follow the finer points of this stuff, basically, more dollars are created outside the United States and inside the United States every year in the form of dollar loans done by people who can't get access to the Fed. So if those loans end up on the balance sheets of financial firms that don't have dollar access and those loans go bad, they're really, really in trouble. And that reverberates back to the US and to everyone else. So to kind of cut those transmission mechanisms, the Fed agrees to swap large amounts of currency. Mm-hmm. So yens for dollars, pounds for dollars, et cetera. So that those central banks actually have access to dollars and can effectively bail out their banks.
Yep.
Now, after 2008, a lot of people went, hang on a minute. So we put taxpayers' money in the Royal Bank of Scotland group that was run by Fred the Shred. We bailed out the Germans who were running operational leverage of 60-1 on an average Tuesday.
Yep.
Why are we doing this? This is nonsense, right? Mm-hmm. So a really democratic monetary policy would actually see these as dreadful risks and externalities and would probably get rid of them, which would make the entire system more democratic, but a lot more risky. Is that worth it?
Yep. From a democratic perspective, yes, it has to be, as you say, right? Like, absolutely. So monetary policy, as if democracy matters, as the book title suggests, like, would have to be more stringently domestically empowered, like, for sure, right? But, like, but then the question is, like, okay, well, then maybe I'm just not democratic because that's just insane, right? I actually don't think it is that insane, right? So I think drawing more clear domestic lines around the sort of things like swap lines, right? The euro dollar market, regulation of the euro dollar market, et cetera, would actually be, in my view, a good thing.
Right.
Because one, from a democratic perspective, because you're getting more democratic input over that. But two, also because like do we really think that the system right now is a good one? Like it's the Fed that's deciding the thing you left out of the story, right, is that the Fed decides who gets those swap lines. Not everybody gets them.
That's right.
Right? Like some countries are like, please, can we have dollars? We desperately not need dollars. And Jay Powell, not Jay Powell, but would be in the future, would say, actually, no, today I don't really like your country. So I'm not going to do that.
Exactly.
So like both wildly undemocratic, but also like totally arbitrary and kind of bizarre. I mean, not totally arbitrary because it's done because it's on the basis of, going back to the founding of the Fed, securing the stability and effectiveness of the financial system, right? The international financial system.
So if Deutsche Bank blows up, that's probably your problem as much as it's Germany's problem.
Yeah, but like is the Fed saving Deutsche Bank really the best move like in the long term and especially from a democratic perspective for the global population? I'm not so sure. So like, I don't know. My view is that like, it's a tricky question in the sense of like, what's the alternative, right? Is the alternative like international collapse because nobody does anything as a result? Mm-hmm. That's bad. Is the alternative that it's that the U.S. exerts more domestic control over monetary policy, including things like swap lines mm-hmm. and the euro-dollar market. And as a result, there is an international reaction to that, which is like, oh, I guess we can't depend on the international euro-dollar market anymore mm-hmm. and all this massive financial speculation that goes on the back of it. We need to sort something else out
right.
that's either more domestically democratic in their own country, or there's a new political discussion about international mm-hmm. financial governance. But right now, it's like all pretty shady mm-hmm. and like – I'm not a big fan.
And I'm sympathetic to that in the sense that the sort of the turn to technocracy works so long as you have what I call output legitimacy, right? That basically you say you're the best sausage maker, the sausages are delicious. Mm-hmm. And then when it all goes wrong and the sausages taste bad, people say, who put you in charge in the first place? And then the whole thing becomes politicized in a different way. But the counter to that is the adults in the room claim, right? Mm-hmm. That in a time of increasing polarization, media fragmentation, and people believing, frankly, whatever they want, the world does work in certain ways. People do have certain degrees of expertise. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you do things like just basically have a tariff war for the sake of it, it probably will be damaging.
Yeah.
And it probably will not result in the mass reindustrialization of 30 million jobs, right? Probably, let's be honest, it's not going to work, right? So if that's the case, don't you want the adults in the room? I mean, in the sense that it's the least bad option, because I want to be a Democrat. I want to be a Democrat with you, but I don't want to be a Democrat with these guys.
No. But like the argument that I'm making is not that we don't want the like adults in the room or that we don't want to use the best sausage maker to make our sausages, right? The whole claim is that what we want is to employ expertise in a democracy, but not be ruled by experts, right? So how do you create a system in which the legislature is still maintains a certain degree of effective power mm-hmm. over the expert, right? So like, I want you to think about, you know, more investment in North Carolina and less in California, but also recognizes that like they don't have the expertise. So like they're employing that expertise and showing them sort of here are some options, here are how we can do that, here's how we can do that. So you still have the adult in the room. Mm-hmm. It's just that the sausage maker isn't in charge, right? Right. They're responding to a different degree of
you're
like
you're telling them
power.
Whether you're making Italian sausage or not.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And like as a like not only is that I think more democratic, but it also interestingly would allow for a different relationship between the legislature and the expert that mm-hmm. could actually enable the discretion of expertise, right? So like if the expert is not obsessed with adhering to a mandate because that's the sort of legal technical way yeah. in which they're like, you know, legitimate, but instead is engaged in like an active management mm-hmm. relationship, right? Then you get a lot more sort of creativity and you could get better kind of policy outcomes, right? So I think about this with like, you know, think of any management relationship, like a manager and their employee, mm-hmm. right? Instead of saying, like, I'm writing out four things for you to do. It's mm-hmm. like, we'll check in. We'll see how it's going. You tell me what's working, what's not working, that kind of thing.
Right.
So it's not that I want to like rid the world of technocrats and experts. Like, I love the administrative state. I want to build it in a way that's actually sustainable and empowers democracies over time.
And doesn't become
than
a target. Doesn't become
yeah.
a target of
yeah.
the democracy.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. Exactly.
And I'm particularly struck by your idea that ultimately by not letting them hide behind fiscal rules,
yeah.
not letting them hide behind, oh, the central bank's got that,
yeah.
you kind of, you reprofessionalize politics. You
exactly.
say you have to be serious people.
Exactly. It's like, we're you this is your power, and therefore you have to like deal with it. And so I think both you're reprofessionalizing them, you have to be serious people, and you're going to attract, like, politics is not a very attractive business for a lot of very intelligent, curious, like ambitious kids these days. Like my students, I don't know about yours, are not very interested in politics. Mm-hmm. Like, and that is, I think, a part of virtue of the fact that we just like have completely sucked it dry
right.
of like actually being able to do something. I mean, it's no wonder people are voting for parties all over the world that are saying, let's blow it up, like, you know, drain the swamp, take back control. Because it's true, in a sense, that politicians have delegated away so mm-hmm. much power that, like, it doesn't really matter who's in
yeah.
that seat. And that is not a good state for democracy if
no.
it doesn't matter who's in that seat.
Exactly.
Right?
Is there anything else that we haven't covered?
Oh, boy. I think it's just worth maybe like emphasizing at the end too that this whole point about like democracy and it being risky and like embracing that, like it's a tricky thing to argue, especially at this moment in time. But I think one analogy that I use at the end of the book that I found useful was like was suffrage, right? Mm-hmm. So at the time when women were arguing for the vote, one of the major arguments against was that's just going to produce bad policy, mm-hmm. right? Like we can't let women vote. That'll produce bad policy. But it was obviously the democratic thing to do to extend the vote to women. And in the end, obviously, that wasn't the case that mm-hmm. like women voting produced bad policy. But it also was just you have to take the conclusions of the argument if you're really gonna commit to it, right? So if you want to sit there and tell me that like actually I care more about the stability of the international financial system than I do about democracy, then like, okay, fine, that's your prerogative. Right. But like if you're going to say that you are committed to democracy, then like this is the conclusion. Yeah. You know, and like we have to have that conversation in the country. And I don't think we have yet.
You might have wanted to call the book The Democratic Risk.
Oh, I like that.
Because that's ultimately the essence of what you've got to take the democratic risk.
Yeah.
All right. Maybe that can be the title for your next
there
one.
There you go. Next one. Yeah.
Exactly.
All right. I'm on it.
Well, Leah Downey, thank you very much for coming in and being on the podcast.
Thanks for having me. It's been a lot of fun.
This episode of the Road Center podcast was produced by Dan Richards and Sabrina Klumek with a video production by Azure Cruz. If you like the show, leave us a rating and review on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And while you're there, be sure to subscribe too. We'll be back soon with another episode of the Road Center podcast. Thanks for listening.